I'm telling these tears, go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom, I came.
What's up, Wisconsin? Happy Friday, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn, host of The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm glad it's Friday. It's been a busy week. Busy week, and certainly it's not going to be a Maggie Dawn Show if the show itself is not also busy. So let me give you all the rundown of the great show that we've got planned for you today. Of course, I'm joined by my wonderful producer and partner in this endeavor, Brian Kelly. If you do give us a call or text during the show, 855-752-4842, be real nice to him. Blame me for anything else that goes wrong. That's the way it goes. So always say hi to Fancy Brian. We call him Fancy Brian because his name, we spell with a Y. So does he. And we've got great guests today. I'm excited to start off the day with Professor Charles Franklin of the Marquette Law School poll. They just published a new one on Wednesday. We'll dig into that. And we just confirmed moments before I came on air that though we had to reschedule Representative Jim Clyburn of the 6th Congressional District in South Carolina, we're going to have him back today. They were kind enough to make time again for our little show here. He'll be joining us at 2:20. We've got Professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat of New York University. She is an expert on authoritarians. Seems, I don't know, possibly an appropriate topic of discussion these days at 3 o'clock. Of course, I'm going to be talking money. Got a real special guest. His name is Barry Lynn. We're going to be talking about lots of things. We'll even relate it to the Boeing strike, which started today. And last but not least, we got Terry Barr at 3:30. Civic Media's very own Terry Barr. We're going to talk about what's good, local, and overlooked. So keep it locked in, folks. We got a great show planned. And without further ado, let's jump right in. Welcome back, Professor Franklin. Great to have you here. Thank you for your continued wonderful work in polling. Wednesday was a new poll, and there was some movement, was there not?
There was a little bit. Thanks for having me back. We have the presidential race at 4-point lead for Harris, 52-48. That's true of both registered voters and likely voters. When we polled a month ago, after Biden dropped out, but before the Democratic convention, Trump led by 50-49 with registered voters, but Harris led by 50-49 again, but with likely voters, she was ahead. And when we threw in the third party candidate, she went up by 2 points. So this time she's up by 4 with both slices of registered and likely voters. That's a little bit of movement. Now, our poll was done beginning the week after the Democratic convention. So this is capturing the convention effect, if there was one, but it was completed before this week's debate. We'll be in the field next week with our post-debate poll.
So very important facts there about the timing of the poll. Just for us consumers of information, Professor, it's always good to actually pin down when was the poll out in the field. This one, again, post-DNC, but pre-debate. So were you at all, anything in this most recent set of polling numbers, Charles, that surprised you?
Well, I think we're seeing Harris doing a bit better than she did initially. There's been a little bit of an improvement, not just in the vote, but in favorability. Mm. Her favorability number went up. It's now 47 favorable, 51 unfavorable. So she's 4 points underwater on that. But Donald Trump is 13 points underwater. So, and that's an improvement from Harris. She was down in the low 40s in favorable a month ago, right after she got in the race. So that's an improvement. When we ask about a variety of traits like honest, intelligent, a good communicator, she's doing better than Trump on those. Trump still does better on, has a record of accomplishments. And the two are almost tied, but with Trump a shade ahead on being a strong leader. But Trump also has deficits on being too old by a lot compared to her, and also on having behaved corruptly, where more than 61% say that describes Trump. So all in all, a bit of an improvement across those measures, not just in the vote measure.
I think an interesting data point that you just noted there, Charles, was that would be a strong leader or is a strong leader. I think that's really interesting that you're seeing perhaps about a rough tie. And again, pre-debate, we'll see whether those numbers move much at all. My how times have changed, Charles, across those various qualitative factors that you ask about.
No, that's exactly right. And here the comparison with Biden is just pretty striking. At the convention, Trump focused on strong leader in order to attack Biden for being weak. But now with Harris as the candidate, they're running pretty close to each other. Mm. Trump in his campaign events has attacked Harris as being low IQ, not smart. But on this measure, people see her as a little bit more intelligent than they see him. So these are things that are worth tracking because they're part of the campaign's rhetoric, mm-hmm. part of what they intend to convince voters on. And so we're looking to see whether voters follow along with that or whether they don't agree with the campaigns.
Yeah, again, interesting point of note that the two thematic attack lines, she's not a strong leader and she's dumb, don't seem to actually be showing up in any of the polling. Rhetorical, but perhaps that's why Donald Trump's campaign is encouraging him to not talk about those things so much.
Well, and because on the flip side, on the policy issues, those haven't changed as much
right.
since we switched candidates. Trump still has a pretty strong lead on better able to handle the economy, a strong lead on handling immigration and the border, and a substantial lead on handling the Israel-Hamas war. Those were the same strong areas for Trump against Biden. Harris has the lead on abortion policy especially, but also on health care, on Medicare and Social Security. Those were also Biden's strengths, but Harris is a little stronger on those than Biden was. And she's narrowed but not overtaken Trump on the first three that I talked about where Trump is stronger. So just what you would think, changing the candidates really has changed people's perceptions there, but it hasn't really changed the issues that much. The one thing to make a point of is that on what's the most important issue is still the economy by a big margin. But abortion policy has moved into second place here in Wisconsin, and immigration has been slowly but steadily eroding. It's now in third place, several points behind abortion policy.
Fascinating. Certainly, some of the commentary coming out of the debate was Vice President Harris's articulate and concise and clear, viewpoint on abortion, her ability to talk about it, frankly, and many commentators acknowledging that President Biden had a generational, it was hard for him to talk about abortion. He didn't have the ability to use those humanizing stories as the vice president did on the debate stage with the degree of effectiveness that she has been able to do. So it'll be interesting to follow this bouncing ball and see where it ends up as we go through these now less than 60 days to the election. Let me turn and ask you about the vice presidential nominees. Now we've got both nominees. You're able to do some head-to-head comparisons. What are you finding on the J.D. Vance, Tim Walz matchup?
Tim Walz is the one of these candidates who has a net positive favorability. He's 6 points more favorable than unfavorable, though 19% still say they haven't heard enough about him to have an opinion. With Vance, he's a net negative 10 points more unfavorable than favorable. And he's a little bit better known than Walz, but not that much. He's got 16% that don't have an opinion of Vance. So bottom line is, if you go down this list plus the third party candidates, Walz is the only one with a net favorable, followed by Harris with a little net negative. And then Vance and Trump are both around minus 10 or minus 13.
I also thought the polling about whether or not the choice of running mate was an excellent or good idea was an interesting comparison. Tell us about how that stacked up, Charles.
Yeah. And we asked these after the Republican convention. We asked about Vance, after the Democratic convention, we asked him about walls. 90% of Democrats say that walls is an excellent or good choice. And in the Republican case, it was 75% of Republicans said that Vance was an excellent or good choice. So both parties are pretty unified behind their VP picks, but it is noticeable that Vance is 15 points seen better by Democrats than, Walz is 15 points better with Democrats than Vance is with Republicans.
I also thought the matchup of where the picks rated on sort of the, are they very liberal to very conservative? I thought this comparison was fascinating as well, Charles.
I think this is really interesting because the attacks on Harris and Walz are that they're extremely liberal and so on. People do see Harris as extremely liberal, but they see Trump as just as extremely conservative. There's not much difference, 1 point difference, honestly, between the two on that. But on the VP case, even more, 61% see Vance as very conservative. It's much lower. It's in the 50s, low 50s for Walz as very, very liberal. And a much bigger percentage see Walz as moderate rather than seeing Vance that way. So we talk a lot about Walz's record as governor and the progressive legislation that he signed, but we also talk about that Midwest dad who would stop and change your flat tire. At least so far, I think we're seeing Walz maintaining that Midwestern dad image rather than the very progressive Minnesota governor.
Yeah, I have been enjoying watching Tim Walz get interviewed because it reminds me of my family members, if I'm being totally candid. Listen, Charles, thank you so much for all you continue to do. After your next round of polling, which goes into the field next week, we'll be sure to have you back to check back in on where the numbers stand then.
That's great. I'm always happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Folks, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. Here on the Civic Media Radio Network, we expect to have Representative James Clyburn joining us after these brief messages. He's one of my personal heroes. You're not going to want to miss this. He's been a lifelong resident of the 6th Congressional District and helped Biden edge to the top of the Democratic field in 2020. Keep it locked, folks. We'll be back with more here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Don't care about those people, man. I could care less what they think.
Welcome back, Wisconsin and beyond. My name is Maggie Dawn, host of The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. The thing that makes this job such a privilege to do is that sometimes you get the chance to talk to one of your personal heroes, and today is one of those opportunities for me. It is my humble privilege to welcome South Carolina Congressional Representative Jim Clyburn to the show. Welcome, Congressman. It truly is one of my life's greatest privileges to talk to you this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
You've been a member of Congress since 1993. You were House Majority Whip from 2019 to 22, as well as 2007 to 2010. You were the first African-American to serve multiple terms as Majority Whip. You've won the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And one of your most widely known accomplishments, sir, is that in 2020, you helped deliver South Carolina for President Biden in the primaries, helping to propel him onto the presidency. Sir, thank you for saving America then. Yesterday, this morning, President Biden had a celebration, a Black Excellence Brunch. Tell us about why that event was so important, why it was the first of its kind. I just think that this was a remarkable moment and certainly coming full circle for the Congressional Black Caucus and President Joe Biden.
Well, it really was very remarkable, but not surprising to those of us who really know Joe Biden. I could not get to the lunch because I had previously scheduled an event on get out the vote stuff. But my eldest daughter did attend, and I hope that she represented the family well. But it was so important for Joe Biden to continue to fill in what I call the gap between the bookends, him having served as vice president to the first African-American president that we have had in this country's history, and him having named as his running mate the first woman to ever serve as vice president in this country, and hopefully have handed it off to what could very well be the first woman president of these United States. That, to me, bookends a 50-year career of having done the right thing when it comes to communities of color, communities of low to moderate income, the kind of communities that very seldom get the real impact of what this country's greatness is all about. I say all the time that this country is great in no need of being made great. We need to work together to make this country's greatness accessible and affordable for all of its citizens. And if you look at the legislation that Joe Biden has championed, the Rescue Act, which immediately lifted almost half of the children living in poverty out of poverty, you look at his infrastructure bill that included in it not just roads and bridges, but water and sewers, cleaning up all the lead pipes that children were exposed to in many communities, getting lead pipes out of the system. Broadband in rural communities, low-income communities where they didn't have broadband internet, and in dire need, it's in there. $65 billion of those that money, $1.2 trillion, going for that. Chips and science, bringing those chips back to this country when they had been gone, all except about 2% of them had left the country. And then we get out to have our tax system to make it profitable for people to have those chips made overseas and then bring them back into this country. Look at what he did with Inflation Reduction Act, what he did for the price of insulin. My late wife fought a 30-year battle with diabetes. I saw her insulin bill sometimes $600 a month. That's now capped for seniors at $35 a month. Safer Communities Act, the PAC Act for veterans, going back and picking up those veterans from the Vietnam War that gotten left out. So Joe Biden has had all of this. And then to be able to book in all of that with the vice presidency under Barack Obama and the presidency with Kamala Harris as his running mate, and hopefully have handed it off to what could very well be, will very well be, hopefully will be, the first woman president of these United States. That's what this Nuts Today was all about.
Yes.
Reminding people what his place in history is all about, and thanking them for the role they played in putting him in position to do all of this, which includes putting the first African-American woman on the United States Supreme Court.
Indeed, sir, from your lips to God's ears, I long for the day when Kamala Harris raises her hand and takes the oath as not just the first female president, but the first Black female president. What a day that will be, because Joe Biden knows what kind of jobs are Black jobs. They're vice president, they're president, they're Supreme Court justice. Representative Clyburn, when you hear when you hear Donald Trump talk about Black jobs, what do you want voters to know about what he's actually saying, sir?
What he is saying is that we are relegated to certain jobs. I know that relegation excludes the vice presidency. That's why he keeps wanting to make her something other than an African-American woman. Someone who chooses to go to college at an HBCU, historical black college and university.
Yes. Yes.
Someone who chooses to affiliate with a sorority in college, and it becomes the first African-American sorority on a college campus.
Yes.
So she made those choices as a high schooler and a sophomore in college. And then you said she never admitted to being black. she always accepted herself as being black. And so what it says to me is this man can't get over the fact that black people, male and female, stand on equal footing with him. There's supposed to be certain jobs for us. And that's why only the people who come into this country without citizenship and without educational backgrounds for certain positions, those are the black jobs that are being taken away. So we're going to remind him on November 5th that black job you're talking about is the job that black guy had as our 44th president.
Indeed, sir. Thank you so much for making time for us here in the state of Wisconsin. I appreciate your work on behalf of each and every one of us, not just the 6th District of South Carolina, sir. You've been a great hero of mine. Thank you again. And go Kamala Harris, because we're not going back.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Take care, sir. Folks, that was Representative Jim Clyburn, bye-bye, sir, of the 6th District in South Carolina. I'm Maggie Dawn, host of this, The Maggie Dawn Show, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We have a fabulous guest coming up next. It is another one of those busy days here on The Maggie Dawn Show. You're not going to want to miss it. We're going to talk about authoritarianism with Professor of History and Italian Studies at NYU, Ruth Benjiat. She knows all about this. She's literally written the book on it. Maybe she'll have something to say about the sorts of things that Trump talks about, because we all should be very scared. Keep it locked. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
We are not going back.
What's up, Wisconsin and beyond? My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It is my privilege, and it is oh so timely, to be joined by our next guest, Professor of History and Italian Studies at New York University, Ruth Benjiat. Welcome, Professor. Thank you so much for making time. You are basically an expert in fascism and authoritarianism, as well as propaganda and democracy protection. Given the choice that is on the ballot in November, I really appreciate you sharing your expertise with all of us here. Thank you for being here.
Sure, it's a pleasure.
Your latest book is called Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. And I want to begin. Donald Trump just finished a press conference not too long ago. He was in L.A. And during the press conference, he spoke about migrants. A reporter asked him about the bomb threats that today closed the City Hall of Springfield, Missouri, two schools, and Springfield's DMV. The bomb threats that were phoned into these places referenced migrants. This is, of course, after Donald Trump and J.D. Vance amplified and continue to discuss just sickening racist tropes about folks that are in Springfield, Missouri, legally from Haiti, who've helped revive that economy. The specific language that Donald Trump used this afternoon, Professor, was nests, that immigrants are in nests. And he again referenced mass deportations. He moved right from the question about these bomb threats being called in to an affirmation of his mass deportation policy. Professor, as I listened to the former MAGA president, and as I have many times, his rhetoric sounds like Nazi Germany. The tools that he plans to deploy seem to me to be a step towards fascism and authoritarianism. You wrote an opinion piece for the LA Times just a few months back, where you questioned whether Donald Trump would actually, if elected, stop free and fair elections. As an expert in authoritarianism and fascism, how concerned should we be? How far along this pathway, this sliding back away from democracy and towards authoritarianism, have we gotten?
Yeah, it's very disturbing to hear speeches like that, because Donald Trump, there's a very good reason he's constantly praising the worst murderist leaders of our day, from Putin to Xi Jinping to the leader of North Korea. Those are the people he is holding up as role models. He wants to be a dictator. He says he's going to be a dictator. And one of the things dictators do, and you're right, this language is, he calls migrants vermin, people who have to be rooted out. They always use the word nests. So all of this dehumanizing language goes straight back to fascism. Mm. And you select one group to be particularly dehumanized, but there's always other groups who follow, right? And once you create the infrastructure of camps and talk about deporting, you know, one group, those camps and those internment centers or whatever they are in each case are used for other groups. It's very, very dangerous. He already did huge damage to our democracy when he was in the White House. And this is just like an acceleration and a kind of becoming more and more extreme in view of the election. And I'm very concerned.
As I am, I share that concern. Let's talk about the sort of process and the pieces of government that fascists have to control in order to effectively assert their will and maintain power. And one of the things that I've heard people expressing continuing and accelerating anxiety over is Trump's desire to get rid of civil servants and to basically require loyalty tests for anyone that works at a high level of federal government, and what that could mean, especially for the military. Is this something that is just rhetoric from the left, Professor? Or is language like that saying, you know, I deserve to have people that are loyal to me in these positions of power throughout federal government to demand loyalty of members of the military? This is not a hypothetical, is it? I mean, this is the literal playbook of fascists and dictators, is it not?
Yeah, and he also partly did this to certain, like the EPA, which because of his alliance with plunderers of the environment was a target while he was already president. He already kicked a lot of people out and found ways to get rid of them. So this, what you're referring to, the concept is called autocratic capture. And it's done by all authoritarians. Today, Viktor Orban, who's the hero of the GOP, and at the debate, Trump even like referenced Viktor Orban, who likes him as though it's a good thing. You know, Hungary was just ranked the most corrupt country in the EU. And so you see how that goes very well with Donald Trump's aims. But autocratic capture is when you literally, almost like pirates, you take over. It's like a hostile takeover of government institutions, the civil service. You get rid of anybody who's not loyal to you, and you hire people based not on their expertise or professionalism, because you don't want them to have ethics, because you're not about the rule of law, you're the opposite. And you end up with these people who will just rubber stamp things you want to do, who have no ethics, but they're loyal to you and to the party and to the cronies. And you do this to the judiciary, you do this to the election machinery, to all the government institutions. And that way you have like a coherent strategy for doing even the most heinous things. And you're, so what he's doing with that, and this is also Project 2025, this kind of purging and recreating of government. And it goes back to fascism. The first person who did this was Mussolini. And I went back to the sets of laws that were passed or right after Mussolini declared dictatorship. And a lot of them are similar to what Project 2025 wants to do.
I mean, as I was reading Project 2025, and I was fortunate enough to have a period of time in my education where I was studying authoritarianism and fascism, and that's what jumped off the page to me in mm-hmm. incredible, sharp, sharp relief. We actually have the sound of Trump talking about nests. Let's take it very briefly, because I want to ask you, like, what does this end up looking like for people on the ground? Like, what is this slow march? What are the compromises in individuals' ethics that will be made each time we take another step towards fascism or moving away from democracy? Let's take a listen to the Nest sound very briefly. Again, folks, my very special guest this half hour is Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's a professor at NYU. She's an expert on fascism and authoritarianism. This is the former MAGA president just moments ago in L.A.
Go there. I can say this. We will do large deportations from Springfield, Ohio. Large deportations. We're going to get these people out. We're bringing them back to Venezuela. You know, he told Biden he's not accepting anybody back. They moved all their criminals, not all of them, but the rest are moving in now. They emptied their jails in Venezuela, emptied their criminals, emptied their nests. They call them nests of bad people. They're all now in the United States, and they're now taking over cities. It's like an invasion from within. And we're going to have the largest deportation in the history of our country. And we're going to start with Springfield and Aurora.
It's hard to listen to it. I had to listen to it live. Listening to it again is equally disgusting. But you talk about how they start with one group, that perhaps there's some appeal, right, to vilify, right? That's had traction for many on the far right. But the groups that this is expanding to, you know, the question of who's next, the LGBTQIA community. Oh, that happened under Hitler's Nazi Germany, right? Women who exercise reproductive rights, right? Political enemies, donors who have donated to the opposing candidates, prosecutors, the very people who operate in the justice system. What are the compromises? And by that, I mean the trading away of your basic ethical beliefs. This doesn't happen like a light switch, does it, Professor? This happens in a process, in this sort of slow erosion that we are seeing. What do people in our everyday lives need to be looking out for?
So I address this in, I actually added a corruption chapter to my book, which was the first book to look at Donald Trump in historical perspective. He's in the book. And I looked at how corruption's like a contagion. And you have to have unscrupulous people in the government to allow for a kind of collapse of ethics. Mm. And that started in Trump 1.0, so many people disobeying the Hatch Act. Yeah. They revised the application for the civil service so you didn't have to disclose as many things. Of course, you had numerous, you know, unscrupulous people, Jared Kushner, that whole, like, hiring your family. That's a classic autocratic thing because they conceal your corruption. So what it looks like is ultimately, you know, authoritarianism asks you to betray each other. And Trump has been conditioning, this is one of the scariest things, he's been conditioning Americans not only to see murderous dictators as positive, like I said before, but he's been conditioning the average American to see violence differently, to see it as something that might be necessary, and also to see his self-dealing and corruption in a different light. And so the GOP has become a party that that celebrates criminals, that's full of criminals, actually. And that's why the January 6th thugs who have been prosecuted, Trump is calling them patriots. Yeah. Trump is calling them political prisoners. So that in authoritarianism, who is a patriot and who is a criminal? That relationship changes because I always say that authoritarianism is about transforming the rule of law into rule by the lawless. And when you have as the nominee of the party a convicted felon, and you have numerous people flowing into the party and being pardoned, all authoritarians pardon criminals, because why should people who are useful be sitting in jail or have charges over their head when they could be useful? Because those are exactly the kind of people you need.
Yes.
So it's a process, and you can, if you want to see if a party's becoming autocratic, you look at things like that.
Well, and they're checking all of these boxes, right? Where you pardon the criminals. It's not rule by law or the rule of law. It's rule by the lawless. A convicted felon as the candidate. Corruption becomes the norm. Criminality and violence is excused, now even embraced. Overtly racist rhetoric and policies, the otherizing of enemies, the broadening of that circle, all of these boxes getting checked and checked and yet checked again. And you call it conditioning. I think that's really, really critical because, again, I don't know any conservative friends of mine who would have, if I asked them if they would embrace all these things 10 years ago, would have been like, oh, yes, I'm absolutely for that. I'll vote for someone who's a convicted felon for president. Mm-hmm. But it's the conditioning that's happening. We're going to have more with my very special guest, Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's a professor of history and Italian studies at NYU, but she is an absolute national expert on fascism and authoritarianism. Her 2020 book is called Strongmen: Mussolini to the Present. Our discussion continues. Just a couple of quick fact checks. First of all, it was Springfield, Ohio, not Missouri. My mistake. These immigrants and migrants that are in Springfield, they're not from Venezuela. They're from Haiti. And the vast majority of them are there legally and have been there for a while. Folks, we'll be right back. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
He says, you're not going to be a dictator, are you? I said, no, other than day one.
Welcome back, Wisconsin, or welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Got a great guest this half hour helping all of us get a little bit smarter. Her name is Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's a professor of history and Italian studies at NYU. She's an expert on fascism and authoritarianism. She's been a commentator on CNN, MSNBC, PBS, and now, of course, the Civic Media Network. Her book is called Strongmen: Mussolini to the Present. One other element that you see in authoritarian regimes is also sort of the purchasing of loyalty. Corruption sort of scaled up. Bribery becomes the norm. There were two decisions, obviously, in this last Supreme Court term, Professor, that speak to these issues. One was, of course, the presidential immunity case. The other being a decision that I still find to be bizarre, I guess would be a word, where in effect the court ruled that it's okay if you pay a government official for doing the thing that you wanted them to do, just as long as it's afterwards and don't call it a bribe. Where is this Supreme Court? You know, like, the courts are supposed to be a check on these kinds of norm violations, law violations, and criminality by people in elected offices and in high-powered appointed offices. What are we looking at when we look at the U.S. Supreme Court as it's currently constituted?
Yeah, so one of the things, so I'm born here and, you know, grew up in the States and all that, but I'm not a U.S. historian. And so one of the things that's been very helpful is that I look at the U.S. with the lens of global autocracy. And my book is a global book, and Trump is in it, as is the GOP. At the end, like, so we can kind of have the context for this. So when I look at the Supreme Court, I see it as stacked with several, and this is Alito and Thomas most of all, dangerous far-right operatives. That's how I see those two. Mm. And to a lesser extent, Kavanaugh and Roberts is, you know, kind of masquerading as more of a centrist than he is. But those two are far-right operatives, as the flag episode and the colossal corruption of Thomas shows, who are using the court to destroy democracy from within. That's one recipe. Today, there are still coups that happen from outside. The military comes, takes over. But it's more common, which is what has happened in Turkey, in Hungary, even in Russia. You use the institutions against themselves. And that's what they've been doing. And the biggest proof is this disgraceful immunity, proclamation and ruling. So that's the golden ring that all authoritarians want. They want to have immunity for official acts, and then they can become untouchable. That is the goal of authoritarians. They kill people. They rearrange government. They do everything possible to become untouchable. And the Supreme Court handed Trump this enormous gift. They're nakedly partisan. So I see this, it's very dispiriting, but things are coming out into the open. And along with this, we've gotten information about the right-wing billionaires who fund these people, like Harlan Crow, who has this, doesn't he have a garden full of statues of dictators? And he has like Hitler memorabilia. I think I'm remembering that's Harlan Crow. And he's one of the main funders of the Supreme Court Justice Thomas.
Yeah.
So these are people who are very dangerous, actually. Alito is a very dangerous extremist with the flag stuff. This is not okay. He should be nowhere near the Supreme Court. He should be disbarred, as should Thomas.
And Ruth, there are so many eerie parallels between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. And I want to ask you about that, because a lot of these same lines, rhetoric, tactics, the impetus to try to take over the court, to rot the institutions from the same side, to foment internal strife within the country. When we're talking about Benjamin Netanyahu, do you also consider him to be a strongman, a wannabe dictator?
Yeah, I wrote a piece for Haaretz, the big liberal Israeli newspaper, in April 2023, because I wanted Israelis to read it, about Netanyahu following the autocratic playbook. And one of the main things he did, so if you are a politician and you have indictments or serious charges against you, normal politicians, or meaning Democratic politicians, do not want to run for office because, right, you know, journalists will start poking around. It's just, you don't want to do that. If you're a strong man, you are compelled to run for office. The more corruption charges and problems with the law you have, the more you're like obsessed with getting to power or getting back into power so you can make your troubles go away. And that was the case of Netanyahu. So the minute he gets back, and how does he get into power? He becomes more extreme.
Yes.
His party, Likud, which was conservative, allied with these far right extremists. And that's how he got there. And then he immediately does the, quote, judicial reform, causing mass protest. You know that Israel had the biggest protest in its entire history, week after week after week. And so that's one chapter of this.
I'm going to jump in, Professor, simply because, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I would love to have you back. Here's we've got about a minute. What should people be looking for and thinking about as we go into November? What should be top of mind for every voter, conservative, liberal, independent, and undecided?
That this is not an election primarily about policy. This is not a normal election. This election is a referendum on what kind of political system Americans will live under. Will it be democracy with fair and free elections, or will it be what Donald Trump wants, some kind of autocracy where he's the dictator?
I'm going to reach out because, Professor, I'd love to have you back next week. This is such an important topic. Thank you so much for your time. That's Professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat of NYU. She is an expert on fascism and authoritarianism. I know I'm now smarter because you joined us. Thank you, Professor. Folks, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show. We're going to be back at the top of the hour with more Maggie and the Millionaires talking money, because it's always about the money, isn't it? Keep it locked here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Bye.
Thank you.
If you're really, really pathetically weak, the country's going to be overrun with millions of people. And if you're strong, then you don't have any heart. That's a tough dilemma. Perhaps I'd rather be strong, but that's a tough dilemma.